Hey, it's True Crime Tuesday. We've talked about it before. What do you do with a case when there's no direct evidence? Can you convict on circumstantial? I think yes. Let's do it.
The growing calls across the nation to defund the police.
To end policing as we know it.
With the mysterious disappearance of four people.
The police found what they called an unusual amount of blood in the family home, though whose blood is unclear.
And the suspect isn't talking.
Guns up, giddy up, Wolfpack. It's Failure to Stop. Literally Earth's best podcast. Congratulations. Of all the hundreds of podcasts that are on Earth, you found the best one. This is the Tuesday installment. This is True Crime. My name's John. I'm a 911 dispatcher on Earth. I can literally actually do that job. You've never thought about 911 before, but that's all I think about because it consumes me. Not only 40 hours a week to be a full-time employee, but also here at this podcast. Joining me, as always, is my former love, a woman who scorned me and left me behind, a woman who could stands all she could stands until she couldn't stands no more, a hot commodity on the singles market. She left me because she saw and heard on the internet that there were hot singles living in her area.
Ew.
And she believed it to be true. And it was true because it was Florida. So they were hot in the literal and metaphorical sense. Kendra Trauma, a former sheriff's deputy, somewhere down in sunny South Florida, where once we walked hand in hand as the waves crashed over our naked feet on the beach, and I cried at the insistence of having bare naked feet, and a shark nibbled at Kendra's toe and disfigured her foot for all time. And it was the worst birthday ever. Kendra, how are you doing?
I'm doing great in the hottest Wang in America.
Wait, what?
Because it's hot.
I
usually say I'm in America's Wang, and then you
I did not this week though, so it's just interesting that you brought that up.
You described it as hot, and then you also described it as a Wang. So,
well, I guess you know the counselor. Remember what she said, that you know two things can be true. I don't know. How have you been in this past? Yes. How have you been in this past week? How are you getting along without me? How's it going? Trying to prove to the world that you're your own unique person with your own interests and things going on. What's your bullshit thing that makes you real and fully formed? Entertain us with your stories of mediocrity.
Well, I've gotten a lot of criticism about my nightly routine of staring at the wall and counting popcorn on the ceiling. So I Googled what normal people do at night to relax. And I saw somewhere that some women like to eat snacks in bed and watch TV, right? Watch some movies. So I decided that I would grab my favorite snack, which consists of extra aged blue cheese and old tomatoes. And I sat down and I watched the complete collection of every Ken Burns documentary that there ever was on PBS.
Civil War!
And then I cried myself to sleep.
Because the Confederates lost, yeah.
Yep.
I could think that would burn you up as a Floridian. You're sitting there eating your moldering tomatoes. How's it going to end? You're like, oh shit, we just lost another railroad.
Well, I didn't know until the Ken Burns documentary.
What's General Lee going to do now?
I didn't know how it ended, so...
All of a sudden, they're panning slowly across that painting of Antietam, and you are crying your eyes out.
It was very suspenseful. I wasn't sure.
Uh-huh. Yep, and that
we no, put in, you know, well, not we, but the Confederates. Blur that.
Whoa!
I just mean
Kendra
we.
Kendra clearly aligned herself.
I put my horrifying foot in my mouth. That's my disfigured foot in my mouth. Anyway, that was great. I did that from 7 p.m. to 2 a.m. every night this week. I really enjoyed it.
Did you know that you could be pro-Confederacy and anti-slavery? There were many freed blacks who fought for the Confederacy.
Yes.
So there you go. Maybe maybe we don't have to have all this moral absolutism about choosing one side or the other, that maybe there were people who believed certain things and those people weren't necessarily wrong. And maybe only the richest 1% of Confederates literally had slaves, and there wasn't that much money in the Confederacy. Otherwise, we wouldn't have lost for having no money. Just something to think about. You know, I don't know.
It's a very interesting thing to think about. Also, a very interesting thing to think about is that I know a person who looks exactly, like, identical to Booker T. Washington, and I'm not exaggerating. I can't share the picture with you guys, but John, I will show you a picture of this person.
Cool.
Anyway, so...
What's interesting is that my mother's side, they came from Illinois. They fought on the regular Illinois cavalry. My father's side did have slaves, though. All the way up till 1972, my grandpa finally let him go. It was kind of a family secret, you know. We still had one left.
At least you're let them go.
Those Bates family traditions die hard. What can I say? Anyway, thank you for trying your hardest to be as weird as me. Because I think that's where the blue cheese and old tomatoes came in. I think when you were sitting thinking this out, you're like, what's the random element I could throw out? Because you always hear me talking about tugboats and, technologically advanced North Koreans from the year 3000 and all this. Like, I've always got like a little bit of an extra thing to throw in there. I call it a kicker. And I think that for you, the blue cheese and the old tomatoes was your kicker.
I don't really know why you think I'm trying. That's what I did.
Okay. Kendra, one of the weirdest persons on earth. It should come as no surprise to anyone that she is the one who could love me and no one else. And now.
That alone makes me really fucking weird, though.
Because she is gone, I will now die alone. Folks, the show is brought to you by Ghostbed. Speaking of dying alone, Ghostbed's made up of people who are already gone. Responsibly harvest, reasonably, sustainably harvest from a whole sea of humanity already passed. Heretofore into that undiscovered country into whose bourne no traveler hath ever returned. That's right, the hereafter. Ghostbed is a wonderful company. They support first responders, firefighters, 911 dispatchers, police officers, sheriff's deputies, tow truck drivers, and did I already say veterans? American veterans only, I've been corrected, by the way. They do not support Iraqi veterans. Unless it was some sort of like turncoat situation, like it's very case by case. Anyway, Ghostbed is now offering 50% off site wide. That means half off. Go over, use the offer code Wolfpack, which is just for you, listener. As the Wolfpack, you are our listeners out there in the audience. You can get discounts, massive, massive discounts on pillows, adjustable mattresses, frames, and frankly, everything that they've got over there. They're going to help you get a great night's sleep. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Deep Christopher Nolan, lasagna-styled, multi-layered dream within a dream sleep. Dreams in which you are sleeping, and sleeping in those dreams, you are dreaming of sleep. That kind of just extra deep sleep is what you're going to get in a ghost bed. Please go over there. Use the offer code Wolfpack. Even if you get 0% down, you get 0% financing, and you have Brian Cohey credit, you could go over there and get an excellent... excellent mattress. Thank you to Ghostbed for always supporting us. We appreciate you. Factor Meals, of course, also is a big supporter of Failure to Stop. So you should support them. Go over to Factor Meals. Use the offer code WOLFPACK50. You could save 50% off to start on everything that you find there. There's over 300 options. Beans, corn, salmon, chicken, rice, broccoli, whatever it is that you love, whatever it is your jam. It should be at home waiting for you when you get off of work. You should not have to leave your job as a 911 dispatcher or a police officer or a firefighter and have to face the throng of ignorant humanity that gets themselves in all kinds of trouble that you have to bail them out of. Don't go to the grocery store. Don't have to sit there and wait for some lady who's just looking at a box of Velveeta wondering how could it be cheese if it's never refrigerated at all. Just don't even go to the store to begin with. In an era of Bidenomics, in an era in which your time is money,
Just go home to the people who love you, even if it's just a fridge full of Factor meals. Eat your feelings with Factor meals. They can help you do your meal prep so that even if maybe you're cutting loose a little bit, you're still doing it right. We appreciate them. Use the offer code WOLFPACK50. Also, the wellness company. If you wanted to get well and own your wellness and own your freedom, you could do that with the wellness company. Get well and stay well with solutions designed by top doctors. Kendra?
Yes.
Whenever I say that from now on, whenever I say designed by top doctors, I want you to go top men. Because like I really liked that last week. It was an Indiana Jones reference. I don't know if you got it.
Are you just trying to clarify that women can't be doctors, John?
I don't know if that's true. I've never met a woman doctor or seen
one. Sorry, women can't be good doctors?
I don't know if women doctors work at the wellness company. So I assume they do, but I don't know. Is it that you just don't want to help me do an ad read? Is it that you just want me to do all of them?
Well, you know, I was going to interject earlier and say something.
Are you mad because I never did the dishes and so I have to do all the ad reads? Is this
your punishment? Revenge? Along with just doing this in general with me. That is your punishment.
Yes. To clarify, if this is your first episode, we are divorced. We have to do this podcast by court order. If we do not do the podcast, believe me, this is insane. Our divorce will be nullified and we will be remarried to each other. And my alimony gets cut off if that happens. And Kendra is not going to pay me out of the kindness of her heart. So in order for me to be sustainably sourced and harvest and to go on, I need that alimony from Kendra. So please listen to the podcast and so we can keep doing. I don't even remember. You got me all off course.
I'm so sorry. Anyway. Let's go back to the wellness company because they're a great, great company
top
and friend of the podcast.
Men. They offer
top
natural
men.
They offer natural supplements like melatonin to help you sleep and to get over your dreams of what it was like to have someone yelling at you for being a constant disappointment. Also, immune support, daily essentials for your mind and energy, your digestion, your metabolism. You get prescriptions. You can stock up before the next emergency. Medical kits, first aid kits, contagion kits. If you get a membership, you can break away from Big Pharma entirely. Use the wellness company. Use the offer code WOLFPACK. You can get 10% off over there. We appreciate them. When you're a first responder, it's critical to stay alert, to stay alive all the way throughout your day. I hate it when I would get killed like before the end of the day. It would always happen like 30 minutes left on shift, I would be murdered. And I was like, I can't believe I just worked 7.5 hours or 11.5 hours only to like die at the end of the day. It killed me at the beginning of the day. A lot of us like getting coffee. And if you didn't know this, correctional officers actually make the best cup of coffee. And why is that? Think about it. They can't get out of there, right? Like dispatchers will have someone bring them coffee. They force the police to bring them coffee. Cops will drive through. Firefighters, you know, they either, you know, just have the best of the best there in the fire station because they have all day to brew the perfect, French press or whatever. Correctional officers are locked in. That means gatekeeper coffee. This was founded by two correctional officers who have firsthand experience working with high-risk inmates, and they recognize the need for a mental boost to start their challenging days, which means caffeine. Caffeine was the critical edge that they had over the inmates. Although the inmates were allowed to work out all day and become Earth's strongest criminals, the correctional officers had caffeine. The coffee beans at Gatekeeper Coffee are hand-selected from roasters right there in California where they're based, and when you buy, your order's roasted within one business day, and it's shipped off to you free of charge for maximum freshness. It's a great deal. Check out some of their awesome blends, like whiskey barrel aged. You could bet that is a correctional officer favorite. Mexican chocolate's the one I want to try, the cowboy blend. Ooh. If you're looking for something else. Or, of course, their maximum caffeine. Please go to Gatekeeper Coffee. That's gatekeepercoffee.com. We don't have an offer code with them yet, but you know what? They're a worthwhile company, and I just wanted to let you guys know if you want to support first responders, correctional officers are the ultimate first responders. They have to enforce the law inside the walls. They have to put out fires, both literal and figurative. They're performing first aid, responding to emergencies of all kinds. They're every first responder all rolled together is what a correctional officer is. So my thanks to gatekeepercoffee.com for hopefully creating an avenue for them to develop wealth independent of having to work in a prison, because working in prison was the hardest job that I ever loved. Kendra, what do we got this week? It's a true mystery that got solved essentially by a jury and a prosecutor telling a good story. But nobody tells a good story like you do. So why don't you bring us up to speed in this case?
Yeah, this is a really good one because it was unsolved, like you said, for a while. And I mean, you put it pretty well. A jury solved it, but we still have nobody. But we have a really good case of circumstantial conviction. So this is a really good one. Of course, this one, again, was very difficult to research. You and I did a good job doing it, though, if I must.
We did a great job. I read two articles, and then when I ran into paywalls, I threw my phone down on the floor. God damn it, I'm not paying $3.99 to this Los Angeles-based newspaper to learn about something that happened in 1991. I don't think that should be behind a paywall, do you?
Probably not. But you know,
no, I should have free access to their work and intellectual property.
They're the ones that put it on the internet, damn it.
Yeah. Why do they tease me? It was the ultimate, like, it was the ultimate true crime cock tease to know that there's a case out there and I can't learn about it. It's really frustrating.
Yeah, I don't like hearing you say that word.
Kendra's face.
So so our case anyway starts. Our case is about John and Anne Rach.
I think it's pronounced Rash. It's Hungarian. So for those of you who are listening and want to know why, they're like, why don't they know how to pronounce Rash or whatever, or race? It's spelled R-A-C as in Charles, Z as in zebra. It's Hungarian. Yes. So I'm sorry. I'm an American. I was born in America. I'm what you would call Native American because I'm from here. So I don't know how to pronounce things that are Hungarian. That's just how it is.
Yeah, I was pronouncing it rakes.
I think it's Raj. Like with a J on the end. Like how you say measure, but sure. It's Raj.
Measure.
Yes.
Well, John and Anne get married. They have a couple of kids in the 80s. They get married. They have a couple of kids. John is a sheriff's deputy out in California near LA and becomes a stay-at-home mom to their three children. As time goes by, the kids grow up, they're teenagers. John and Anne start to have kind of some marital issues.
As we all do,
especially, you know, the law enforcement stuff, you know, it happens. Before they separate though, John did leave law enforcement to become an elementary school teacher. Compton, and they went to couples counseling. They were going to their pastor at their church to get counseling, but unfortunately it didn't really work. Anne decided that she was done with the marriage.
Spoiler alert, it didn't work. That's why we're here, right? Would you, listener, have been surprised? Like, both of them gave their hearts to God and realized he was the center of a healthy marriage and everything turned out okay. We'll catch you next week.
That would make for a very boring true crime podcast. I can't talk. True crime podcast.
But it would be heartwarming.
It would be very heartwarming, but that's not what we do here. So John, John and Anne end up separating in April of 1991. I don't know the exact details. Later, it comes out that there may or may not have been some sort of infidelity.
Now, hold on, Kendra. Those kinds of scurrilous innuendo and lies have been used to damage the reputation of women who have been enduring abuse, both physical, emotional, and verbal. And although her heart may have fallen for an old love, someone who treated her with respect, someone who was willing to listen, someone who cared, does not mean that she had what was coming to her. And in fact, Anne may have endured many hardships herself that drove her heart away and turned her heart hard against John. So we don't know. We have no proof and we have no wish to sully the name or reputation of Anne gone from the earth. But some people say that she was looking to reconnect with an old friend from high school. And that leaving John after their many years of marriage and buying a condo that doubled as a sex pad when the children were not there. Perhaps a way to do that.
That was my slowest
burn ever. I loved it. It was so good.
Thank you for correcting me, John, because you're right. We wouldn't want to discredit the name of an innocent victim. Why are you laughing? This isn't funny.
There was a bee in here.
Anyway, there was an allegation of this later on by John. Unfortunately, Anna's not with us to be able to give her side, so we don't truly know. But as you said, there was talk and rumor of her wanting to reconnect with a high school sweetheart, which I'm not trying to make assumptions here again, but being that they were a law enforcement couple, and we all know how that kind of goes sometimes. There are plenty of marriages that are healthy between a law enforcement officer and their spouse, or two law enforcement officers, or whatever. But a lot of times it just doesn't really work out that way. So it's quite possible that they'd been having issues for a very long time, which I think probably was the case, because she kind of just abruptly left. She moved out with their kids and left a note while he was at work one day.
We used to call that a Dear John letter.
Yes. Which very is ironic because his name is John.
And it's because of how you left me.
Yes.
She has beautiful handwriting. I wasn't even mad. I mean, I was once the full weight of it hit me, and I started just, you know, running into the interstate.
Screaming. Ah!
You know, I thought my life was over, but I'm in too much pain to be dead. So
Anne leaves with the kids, and their therapist, who was also their pastor, as I mentioned earlier, his name is Glenn Thorpe. He becomes actually a pretty prominent player in this whole thing, not in the bad sense, but he kind of helps the investigation along a lot. He tells investigators later on. Glenn Thorpe.
Okay, go ahead.
He tells investigators later on that they were having marital issues, but he didn't really think too much of it because neither of them ever expressed any intention of divorce. And Anne only told him that she was going to do that about a day or two before she actually left. So she'd been planning on this for a while. She made plans ahead of time. She'd had a condo ready. She left, right? So this is all going on. There may or may not be infidelity. There's three children involved. She up and leaves him. One other aspect that I kind of thought about, which I'm not being a sympathizer for John. I'm just trying to give another perspective, maybe to like a motivation. I don't know the circumstances behind why he left law enforcement, but sometimes when you go from a job like that to a regular job, you do have a lot of those feelings of you get insecure, or you feel like you're not really living up to your potential, et cetera, and so on, which are things that we see in family annihilators and people who murder their spouses. So I just thought I'd throw that out there to kind of tie that in there.
We do a lot of family annihilators, and shame is a huge thing. Yes. Not living up to expectations. Yeah.
Yes, correct. And she was a stay-at-home mom, and I don't really know how much teachers make back in the 80s, but I'm assuming it wasn't very much, just like now. So anyway, Anne's gone, the children are gone, but they don't live very far away. They live probably about a mile or two away from John. So about 4 days after she moves out, April 22nd, John and Anne decide they're going to kind of talk about stuff, just how to proceed. I don't think she was going to change her mind, but John was wanting to convince her to reconsider the divorce. She goes over to John's with the kids. She drops them off, lets them play video games. They're hanging out. Her and John, this is all according to John, remember. John and Anne go into the backyard of the home, and John is kind of pleading with her to reconsider the divorce, and he gets not desperate, but he's so passionate about this that he offers to give her a bunch of money to take a vacation so that she can have some time for herself to think it over.
you got to remember what's at stake for him too. You know, when there's a divorce and they have kids, if he's worried about losing custody of those kids, we have seen cases where fathers, when they feel like they're losing custody of their children, there's a case I was looking at recently, and I'm thinking about hitting on the future, but where a father, and just disclosing the details of the case, may those of you who know it may know what I'm talking about, but his wife disappeared under mysterious circumstances, and he was having all kinds of problems, and the court ordered him to no longer have custody of the kid because there was some suspicion that he had something to do with the wife who disappeared. So as soon as he found out that he was going to be losing custody, as soon as the kids came over for a court-ordered supervised visit, he shut the door in the face of the person who was appointed by the court to supervise the visit, and he blew up the house. So fathers will go to extreme lengths when they think they're going to lose their kids. So that could be part of what's informing his thinking as all of his life as he's known it, and his image as a father and a family man is all crumbling.
Yeah. That you actually make a really good point. And I'm sure some of our audience members who are law enforcement could attest to this, but, or maybe even some social workers. I know we have a couple that watch. When it comes to children, even parents that we would deem as like shitty, right? Okay. When they're looking at losing their children, it's almost like a, like some sort of feral primal thing takes over. And I feel like it's kind of instinctual. Those are your offspring, right? But people will do absolutely wild and crazy shit that they would never do under any other circumstance other than when it comes to their kids. And if you have children, which most of you guys do, I know you understand that too. Like, there's no rage like seeing your kid get hurt, right? Or having them, they're in a perceived like dangerous situation. So these custody battles get really ugly, especially when people start poking at each other. I'm not saying that's what happened here. I just think that that's an important thing to talk about because it's so it's such a volatile time in a separation or in any case when someone's looking at losing their kids. And unfortunately, most of the time it ends up being the dad. So
I was going to say that next is that the courts often favor the women. You know,
and that's not always the best answer. Just throwing that out there.
No. Has it occurred to you too, that part of the reason why he might've stopped being a police officer might've been because of the marital stuff. And he thought that if there was a divorce and any kind of custody battle, she would use the police stuff against him. That's something that happens very often when police officers get divorced, is that the mothers say, well, they have to work all these ungodly hours and he can't be there when they're supposed to be home because they're working nights or swings or whatever. Yeah. And you know, the job's dangerous and, you know, I don't want my kids coming home to nothing, or I don't, you know, and I have known police officers who literally gave it up because their family was coming apart and they knew that they didn't want their job as a police officer to be used against them in the custody mm-hmm. battle. So they just proactively quit. And what would be better than going and being a teacher, you know, another steady government job there in Compton where he could be essentially on a daytime hours, you know, steady with weekends off. It seems like the best situation for him to be able to maintain custody of his kids. And if we don't mm-hmm. want to be so cynical about that, like that's the best situation for his family. So it's possible this situation persisted for a long time. And if it's true, if he did find a way to help Anne meet her ultimate demise, this guy's a bit of a planner, Kendra. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really good point too. And again, I don't want anybody to misconstrue this as us sympathizing with him or trying to make an excuse for what he did. We're just trying to build the mindset here.
We can we can understand him without right. condoning him. We can understand what actions he might take and why. And I think it's important if you're going to talk about the evil things that men do, we can't just say, well, you know, people are terrible, people are stupid, people are awful, and then write it off, because we, in order to better confront evil in this world, you have to understand it. And it correct. Was really, really an ugly side of being in law enforcement. Something I really didn't love at all was when I was a correctional officer, was being exposed to the negative psyche and mentality of inmates. And it's something that just being around it destroys your life. But I had to willfully engage with it a lot of the time to understand why people did the things they did. Otherwise, it would have crushed me. Kendra, did you ever have to do any of that, Olivia Benson, Elliot Stabler style soul wrenching, self reflection when you were a police officer? Or was it all just running around, sticking your baton at little kids' bicycle spokes, like I imagine?
No, I mean, for the most part, I was just beating up homeless people and spitting in their open mouths. But every once in a while.
Kendra, that is vile. Oh, vile.
You need to make some sort of artwork. Actually, no, don't do that. Never mind. as it's coming out of my mouth, I'm realizing that's a terrible, terrible idea.
Just
anyway,
like the spit that went into their open mouth. Yes.
Anyway, yes, I did have a lot of moral dilemmas occasionally. Well, a lot occasionally. That's kind of an oxymoron, but
mean that they all fell on like one day.
Yeah. I had one ship where everything was a moral dilemma. But no, I of course, especially when it came to taking kids, or which I wasn't present for any actual, like, we're taking this child now, but I did get to see these types of cases where I didn't necessarily agree with the court's decision, but I had to carry it out because it was a judge's order, and that's what I swore, like, that was part of my sworn duties. So yeah, I had some moments where I was like, I don't know about this. This doesn't seem like a good idea, but I wasn't there to make that decision because the decision was already made. But you still have to live with it because you had to carry out something that you didn't morally agree with. And I think every law enforcement officer has dealt with that on multiple occasions.
That's something you hear on other podcasts too. I know that's kind of our thing, is that we constantly react to other people's podcasts instead of having an identity of our own.
That is our identity.
Yes. A lot of times other podcasts will, I've heard this before, and I don't have a specific example. So on this case, I can't really call out morbid, but you'll hear podcasters who say, looking at a case in retrospect, they know that the police took some action that they know was disastrous. Like the case I mentioned here, where these two boys were placed by the court to have these visits or whatever, and the guy used it as an opportunity to end the entire family's life. A podcaster might look at a situation like that and say, how could a police officer or a court service officer, walking up to the house and smelling the gasoline and seeing that look in his eyes, how could they just let the kids go in there? And the answer is because it's their job. They're supposed to. They know it's tense. They know it's going to be bad. They know that these families are in the midst of violence, that they're in the midst of terror, that they're in the midst of drug use, of crime, and everything else. We can't solve that all as an individual. Sometimes we just have to do the best we can. And sometimes police officers are put into situations that are bad. And sometimes Kendra just, would wait in the bushes. And when the kids rode by, if they were, she just put her baton right in their spokes. And then she would jump out and say, oh, my goodness, are you okay? She already had a Band-Aid, and she would feel good about herself.
Well, I only did that if they had, treats, and then I'd take their treats and run away. If they just left the ice cream truck.
What's your favorite treat, though? Were you taking blue cheese off of these kids?
And old tomatoes.
Give me that.
Give me that. Give me that.
Give me that.
I'm joking. Okay, let's get back to the story.
Go ahead.
Please watch I Think You Should Leave. If you don't, it's fucking hilarious. Anyway, so Anne and John are discussing this reconsideration, right? And John gives her $8,000 and says, go take a vacation, which I wish someone would do that to me.
Just go and think about it. Maybe you need some time to clear your head. I could see that as like being an actual strategy. Like maybe don't throw your life away. Maybe just take a break. Yeah.
Sure. And that's sometimes that's what people need. She had three kids. She was a stay-at-home mom, marital problems. I mean, that sounds like a viable option. So he gives her the money. She agrees. Now, this is, again, according to John, she agrees. She takes off. She goes to the airport. She gets on a plane. She flies away to some sort of destination that we never find out what it is. This is John's account. So she leaves the house, and the children who are still at the home, they recall in court that They were sitting there playing video games. Their mother came up, said, "Hey, I'm going to go to McDonald's and get you guys some dinner. What would you like?" They tell her what they would like. She leaves.
And probably happy meals, because they were pretty lit back in 91.
They were lit, yeah, for sure.
Isn't that before you were born?
In the 90s, though.
You missed also the McDonald's playgrounds. So dangerous, so good.
I was at McDonald's playgrounds, fool. Who do you think I am?
Did you ever climb up inside that Mayor McCheese thing?
I don't know.
Yeah, so you don't know. You were in the climbing around in the nets and like the tubes in the ball pit era of McDonald's.
There were tubes, but
see,
no ball.
I'm talking about a whole era before that in which there's literally a big plastic grimace you climb on, and that's it.
All right, calm down. anyway, so we. I'm sorry, that was very dismissive. So they leave, Anne leaves. And she goes,
yes, you're not projecting at all. We leave.
I'm just recalling the night I left you. She's gone. The kids notice that she's gone for an inordinate amount of time. It seems like a while because the McDonald's is not very far away.
Yeah, and the kids are getting real sarcastic about how fast it is and how McDonald's isn't like how it used to be in the late 70s.
Yes. There's no more grimace to climb on. So the area in which she would have been driving was, again, not very far from the home, and it would not have taken her as long as she was gone. And kids aren't really good at telling time, so the fact that they noticed it was a while means it was probably a long time.
Shots fired, kids. I'm sorry, but when I was first taught to tell time, I was damn good at it.
Someone offer up their child for a roast battle, please, so that I can annihilate them. John comes in. Yes. Would you like to say something?
Just not me. Just listeners. It's not me.
So, yes, this John Raish guy.
The bad guy's always named John in all of our cases, but go on.
He comes through the door to the kids and says, "Hey, your mom is taking some time to think, and she thinks that you guys would like, she told me that you guys would like to stay with me, so you're going to be with me for a while." And he hands them a bag of McDonald's, and they open the bag, and all the food is ice cold, is the way they describe it. It's totally cold. This is a little suspicious. So, because Anne is a very devoted mother, and she's very punctual.
Because in 1991, McDonald's food was hot.
So the kids stay with John and they go to school the next day this was a Saturday that this happened. It was either a Saturday or Sunday. They go to school, they come back, they're expecting to go home with their mother, but she doesn't show. They go back to school, doesn't show. And what the daughter, Joanne, later says that she got sick and tired of wearing the same thing to school because she couldn't go back and get clothes. So she decided that she asked her friend's mother to take her back to the condo. She goes to the unsecured sliding glass door and she notices that all of her mother's things are still there.
Kids probably wearing a lot of corduroy. It's very durable, but... everything kind of goes sour after day three.
Yeah. So all of her clothes, all of her cosmetics, all of the things that you would take on a trip are still in this house, right? So Joanne is obviously very concerned. She's like 14, so she's not like a kid. She knows what's going on.
I was going to say, like, you're like a little kid, like sleuthing it out, like my mom's dead.
No, she's 14 and her brother is 11. I forget how old the third child is, but regardless, they're older. They're not like 6 and 5. She finds this really weird. Her dad's evading all of her questions about it, just saying, "Oh, mom's just gone. She called me yesterday and she said she's fine." He's just kind of blowing it off. Well, she expresses her concerns to her friend, who then tells her mother about it. And her mother and Anne were kind of friends because, you know, their daughters are friends. And at first she kind of blows it off. But
kids are liars. They can't tell time even at age 14.
She blew it off as adolescent drama, quote unquote.
Oh, no.
So a couple more days go by and there's still no sign of Anne, and she's growing very concerned. So she reaches out to Anne's best friend and her sister, who live out of state. All of these people are kind of saying the same thing. Like, this is awfully suspicious because Anne is extremely organized. This was something that many people described her as. She was like meticulous about where she was going, what she was doing, and she was a planner. She was very punctual. She never would go days and days with, first of all, leaving her kids without saying goodbye and giving an itinerary. And B, she wouldn't just not check in with anyone whenever she got to where she was going. One of the things that they said about her was that she would travel quite often, actually, and she would pre-address stamps so that she could mail or... yeah, postcards, so that she could just send them while she's out. She didn't have to worry about it. That on top of like the clothes and all the other things there. Very, very suspicious. So on the 28th of April, so we're 6 days without Anne. John has no real concern. He's very evasive when people ask him where she's at. He claims that she...
There really is no mystery to where my wife is. She simply disappeared, and I'll listen to no more questions about this troubling situation.
That's pretty much his attitude. He just says, well, she called me from the airport. She went on a vacation. Never says to where, never says for how long.
Yeah. Yep.
Just away. So
her and John... Like, she's gone now.
Right, she's gone. Don't worry about it.
What do you mean by that, John? She's gone.
She disappeared.
What, she go to like Palm Springs or where is she? She's gone now. Well, okay. See you tomorrow.
He's just whispering and muttering to himself. Mm-hmm. Glenthorpe, again, they're therapists and they're pastor. John and Anne had an appointment with him on the 27th of April. John called and said Anne wasn't going to make it because she was out doing whatever. And they were going to cancel. But John actually ended up showing up to this appointment and talking to him about what was been going on. And Glenn was a little concerned with his attitude and his demeanor about it, because everyone else was concerned except for John, and every single person suspected that John had something to do with it.
It is usually the husband.
Right. So Glenn reaches out.
I fight for your safety at all times.
just to avoid suspicion.
I literally caught her at the pool once without water wings on. This was last summer. What's he's on? Like, if I drown in the pool, they won't think you did it. They always think the husband, like, well, you're like, well, why are you here? Why aren't you establishing an alibi for yourself somewhere else?
Why are these water wings filled with concrete?
Whatever. No. You have to live. If anyone else kills you, you know I'm going down for it. Think about all the crazy things I said on this podcast. I can't believe, looking over at myself right now, I'm over sitting over there at the defendant's tail. Jury, I didn't do it. No. This is all for
anyway,
the future.
They're playing this in court in like 20 years. They're playing this in court. So Glenn consults with her other friends and family and decides he needs to contact law enforcement because John's not going to fucking do it. So on the 28th, he goes to the sheriff's office, files a missing persons report. The case goes to the missing persons unit, and they conduct an investigation. During their investigation, they interview pretty much everybody that's involved, and everybody has the same things to say that I just expressed, where she's extremely punctual, organized. She would have absolutely no reason to leave her children, but this is what John said, and this is what we found in the condo. So they interview John, and John gives this same story that I've told, but then he says something that's kind of odd. He says that they met with each other on two separate occasions during the week that she was missing. So from the 22nd to the 28th, they had seen each other twice.
So she went on a trip, but she didn't go anywhere actually, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, he was giving her money.
Okay. Just so that she could kind of ramp up to leave.
Right. He was giving her, and he gave her $8,000 the night that she left. The second time that he saw her, it was $7,000. And then the next time, I think it was like $15,000, because he gave her about $25,000 in total, according to him. Hoping that this would incite her to reconsider and want to see that things are changing and blah, 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 blah. So he says that she leaves for LAX to fly somewhere. She goes to a park and ride, parks her van, takes a shuttle, calls him and says, you can either come get it or leave it. I'm going to go to the airport now and goodbye. So he tells investigators that he goes to the park and ride to move her vehicle into a shade because there's a VCR in it and he didn't want the VCR to get ruined.
VCRs were very expensive in 1991. In fact, the first videotape that was the first blockbuster that you could get was, I believe, Top Gun. On VHS, it was $60 in 1991, which like modern money is like $150. So if you think about buying a single movie for $150, VCRs were definitely worth protecting. However, I believe the point you're about to make is if you have a piece of equipment that is very, very high-end AV equipment for 1991, and you have it in a car, and you believe that it's susceptible to heat, as a policeman officer, it's also susceptible to theft in a parking lot. Why would you not simply take that item with you for safekeeping?
Right. It made no sense. Mm-mm. And the investigators thought it was kind of weird, too. And they also thought it was odd that he had absolutely zero emotion about this. He was very point blank. Which, okay, if you're so sure that she went somewhere, why are you not just telling people what happened to quell their anxiety?
No matter how people act, and I've discussed this before, so I won't do a deep dive on this, but no matter how men act when their wives go missing, it's always wrong. Like, you know, with Lacey Peterson, Scott Peterson was too laid back. He was too jovial. This guy in this case, you know, he's too icy and unemotional. What's the right way to act? Like, not so that like I can like learn how to act, but you know,
sure.
But like how are men supposed to act? I mean, I guess there's a certain level of like healthy concern or whatever, but I guess how he should be acting is if these are certain weird things going on, yeah, he should just be really forthcoming, I guess is what he should be doing.
Especially since he was a law enforcement officer. And by the way, the sheriff's office that is investigating this case was his old sheriff's office. So he knows a lot of these people. You would think that he would at least be a little more forthcoming and honest about certain things and know how to properly communicate information with people. But he just doesn't do that at all during this case at any point in time. So
he should also just be smart enough to allay suspicion with enough truth. Correct. He'd just be like, you know what? Me and Anne haven't been getting along for a long time. And she's got this thing with her ex high school boyfriend. She's in this other condo right now. To be honest, her communication's not very good. She told me that she was going to be taking a trip. Frankly, I want her out of my hair as well. The kids are staying with me. This is, for all I know, this is what's going on.
Right.
You know, and then from there, it's like, no, I don't have a key to the place. You know, go talk to the manager. This is the address. Go see what you can find. You know,
right. Exactly.
He should be throwing in enough truth to at least appear cooperative. But by being withholding and not saying much of anything, I mean, he should know that if there's some kind of suspicion about what happened to her and her well-being, of course he's going to be the number one witness or the number one suspect. And either way, he's got to be cooperative, or otherwise it's all going to fall on him.
Exactly. And he is cooperative at first. When she first goes missing, he gives all this information. They go to this park and ride. They find the vehicle. It's kind of parked next to a trailer, like a parked trailer thing. Almost like a, what the heck is it called? Like a portable kind of like building. Anyway, the investigators note that even if he did go there to park the vehicle in the shade, it provided very minimal shade and only for certain times of the day. So it was kind of weird from the jump. They look inside the vehicle. They don't see anything suspicious, particularly. Again, it's just a missing person. So there's no real reason to get a search warrant or do any of that. They have nothing to say that a crime actually occurred. It's just a little weird, but they do go to all of the desks of the airlines that are in this park and ride. and they speak to the attendants and they say, we're looking for this woman. Do you have any record of this person checking into a flight during these dates by either Anne Raish or Rash or her maiden name, which was Yoshiyama? And they're like, no, we have no record of that individual by either of those names at any point in time in the last whatever.
So you could tell that this is kind of where the plan falls apart. He was really hoping they wouldn't investigate beyond that.
Right. So at this point, these investigators are very, again, they're in a missing persons unit. They're not homicide investigators. And they realize, okay, shit just got real. We need to let our supervisor know. And they turned it over to the Homicide Bureau of the Sheriff's Department.
Oh.
So now it's being treated as a homicide because this everything is very, very suspicious. And they're really looking at John because he's the only person involved in any of this that has really some suspicious, reasons.
He's the one who's in the primary position to gain. And we talk about it. Well known. It's usually the husband that, if it was just two people who say were just friends because they had been podcasting together for like 6 months, there's not enough animosity there for those two people to travel across the country to stalk and kill each other or to have some sort of, showdown in the middle of a thunderstorm on top of an abandoned clock tower. It's only the two people who are bound together in legitimate and true holy matrimony who are forced to see each other's miserable face and hear that fucking snoring every night. Those are the only people that could build up that level of animosity where one person could do it another. Ironically, it is love that leads us towards our greatest acts of inhumanity and hatred. Kendra.
Correct. The opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference, right? That's what they say, and that's true. So they start their homicide investigation, and based on the story that was given, they decide to search an area outside of Valencia. This area of California is very canyony and deserty and trenchy and raviney. So all those words I just made up. They decide they're going to send the helicopters up. They can't really do ground search for most of this terrain because it's extremely dangerous to do a lot of the time. If you're from the area or you're familiar with the area, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Wasn't there a detective who worked the case like for the rest of his career and even kind of carried on with it afterwards? His name was Louis Danoff. Did I get his name right?
Yes. And it's funny because they describe him as wearing his
fedora.
His
classic fedora. This is what he used to do. Classic detective's fedora. He would round up a posse of mounted searchers and they would go out and search for the for her body and for her whereabouts. And so it's just kind of funny to think about this guy, kind of an oddball detective with his fedora. He's like mixing genres, right?
Yeah,
he's got the classic detective fedora. So he's like the gritty inner city, 30s detective. But then they're mounting up. So like it's the old Western, like the searchers, John Wayne style, Gunsmoke style of law enforcement. And then for the kicker, the X-Files, he brings two psychics with him.
Yeah.
the psychics are also looking for the body. Skipping to the end, just so that we're not talking about Louis Danoff the entire time. But he went to the eventual trial that would come for John. And he had this to say about the verdict. I'm really, really thrilled. I'm really happy for the new blood that they brought us in to get us over the hump, he said. I can't believe the jury came back so quickly. I'm numb. It's funny when he talks about the new blood they brought in. I would have been like, yeah, do you know neither one of them were psychics, Lewis? I mean, what were you thinking? Kendra, I don't know how you feel about psychic medium work in law enforcement, but it seems like a big bunch of baloney to me. So,
well, they were definitely desperate to the point where they decided they were going to use psychics to try to point them in a direction because all their efforts and all their searching, they couldn't turn up with anything and they had no leads. And the case eventually went cold for 15 years. No sign of Anne. It is a long time. In 2006, I believe it was 2006. The sheriff's office decided they were going to reopen the case. So she's been missing since 91. It's now 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And they, when they reopen and examine everything, they decide that they have enough to pursue John because they, quote, did everything they could to eliminate him.
And they couldn't eliminate him.
And they could not eliminate him, but they had literally no one else. They exhausted every possible theory and lead, which they had pretty much none, to be honest.
You know, there's an old investigatory maximum. Tell me if you've ever heard this. When you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And so they've eliminated all other people on Earth as being impossible, and the only improbable suspect they have left is John. They can't eliminate him. They have no physical evidence to go mm-hmm. by. And this is where circumstantial evidence starts to come in.
Yeah, and one of the more damning pieces of evidence or testimony or witness statement or whatever you want to call it, to me personally, which is something they re-examined, was a neighbor. The day that Anne went missing, a neighbor had a conversation with her, a brief one, like, hey, how you doing, Anne? Blah, blah, blah. Good. Have a nice day. Good to see you. When she left to go get McDonald's, she drove by this neighbor. She stopped. She had this interaction. She left. The neighbor was still outside. And as Anne was rounding the curve to leave the neighborhood, this neighbor observed John leaving the house, quote, in a hurry, getting in his vehicle and following her.
Now, this is circumstantial evidence. What we're talking about is a circumstance in which the last time she was known to be seen was leaving the residence, at least by her children, and in pursuit was John going after her after a discussion. This yes. is all. This is all literally a circumstance. This is not DNA. This is not fingerprints. This is not hair. This is not fibers. This is testimony of an eyewitness nearby. Mm-hmm. And generally, you don't want to make a case strictly on eyewitness testimony because eyewitnesses could be tampered with. They could be wrong. They could be forgetful. They could be all kinds of things. But when you don't have a body to go by, because we've never found Anne, when we don't have those things of direct evidence, we have to start drawing conclusions. We have to use a process mm-hmm. called deduction and interpolation. Interpolation is when you take a set of data and you don't know what comes in the middle, you have to just generally guess. Like Kendra, if I said to you, 2, 4, 6, 8, 12, what are you going to interpolate? 10.
10,
that,
of course.
And that 10 might be the incident of murder in this case. And it seems like a joke or I'm being light or whatever. But if you don't have everything you need to know, you need to start drawing lines together and figuring out, like I said, who stands to gain the most. You know, obviously, John maintaining custody of the kids, any potential payouts from her life insurance, things like that. Not having to go through a painful and embarrassing divorce. All of these things would directly benefit John. And so they'll continue to look at her behaviors and other aspects of her life. And the jury is going to be presented with all these things. And ultimately, the jury is going to be told a story. Does the story make sense? I've described circumstantial evidence and how it works before. Because on TV, you know, the throwaway line of why the heroes can't succeed is, well, that's all circumstantial. Or the guy who's wrongfully confused, I was convicted of purely on circumstantial evidence. This is how circumstantial evidence works. Simple analogy. Your plumbing's broken. Your shower's broken. You call a shower guy, a guy that fixes showers, a plumber. You see him go into the bathroom. You close the door. You hear the sound of work. You're interpolating all this, right? You don't see him like turning his wrench. You don't see him doing all the things that he's doing in there. You have some sense of it. You can bear witness to some of those things going on. I heard sounds. He was in there for a while. And then when he leaves and you gave him money and he gives you a bill and he tells you what was wrong with it, and then you go in there and you turn on the shower and it works, you know that he fixed the shower. It wasn't magic. It wasn't some second guy you didn't see. It wasn't that the shower was never broken. It's that you didn't have all the information, but using what information you have, you can say that you're able to remove reasonable doubt that this is what happened. And the jury was presented with a story about what happened to Anne, how John fit into that story. And they came to believe, despite never having seen a body or known the manner, time, or any of that stuff about her death, that John was directly responsible. And it's something that's really shocking to think about, because you think about Kaylee Anthony, most likely killed by her mother, Casey Anthony. The jury said that, and they had a ton of direct evidence on that, right? They literally had the body in that case. Mm-hmm. They had duct tape, remnants. They had chemicals in the trunk. They had some sort of decay or detritus in the trunk. They had all kinds of physical evidence. They could tell a story about who benefited directly from the death of that baby. It was a mom who got her party life back, who got to go have her her beautiful life tattoo, and got to go go to these parties where she was having a good time and lying to everyone all around her. And the jury came back on that case and said, well, we don't know the time, place, or manner. We don't know if Casey Anthony was with her when she died. And, you know, so we just don't know. So it's just amazing, because we have one criminal justice system. We have a set of laws. Admittedly, they're in separate states under which we're all bound. But things could turn out so differently for a Kaylee Anthony than they can for Ann Rash. And it's just very interesting that we had so much less evidence in the case of Ann, and yet we were able to find a conviction, Kendra.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And you would think that it would be more likely now, since we've learned from cases like Ann's over the years, you'd think that it would be more likely for a situation like Casey Anthony for them to get a conviction. It is interesting, though. I know the jury's, a couple of the jurors said that the biggest thing that they considered was the abrupt break in her pattern. And the trial consisted of mostly of testimony, right? Because there isn't any real exhibits to show. There's no...
What kind of person was Anne? Would Anne leave her kids behind? Would Anne just get up and leave? Is Anne the kind of person that would spontaneously take a trip? Is Anne the kind of person that would leave her car? Is Anne the kind of person that would leave valuables in the car? Is Anne the kind of person that would ditch her car and go off with someone else? All of these things speak to a character and like I said, a pattern of behavior. That is something that they have as an advantage over Kaylee Anthony, whose pattern of behavior is being a toddler. You know, they can't establish what was normal for her, but they could establish what was normal for Casey Anthony, which was partying. But anyway, they were basically able to say, this is who Anne is, and this is how Anne acts. And Anne has disappeared from the earth. She's left her kids behind. One man stands to gain. And it seems obvious to us that she's not somewhere else. So again, they told that story to the jury, and the jury had to decide, was Anne killed? The really, really interesting thing about it is this. This is what it comes down to, and this is why it was shocking when John lost his case and when he was sentenced to, 25 years in prison?
25 to life was his sentence.
And he was 61 at the time of his arrest. He was actually coming back from Thailand, which this was funny. Like, I don't know why he thought that if he was wanted, he could fly back into this country and not be arrested. Anyway.
Yeah, at 8:30 in the morning at the airport, he was arrested.
We get hits. For anyone that we have as a wanted person, if they travel through a port of entry, we get basically informed of that, just in case you ever wondered. So if you are wanted, if you try to go through a port of entry, the agency that it wants you knows where you are. Just something to think about.
Or if you leave, don't come back.
Because even if you made it to Thailand, you know, and they don't, or somewhere where they don't have extradition or the ability or the energy or time to find you. But if it comes down to shadow of a doubt, not having Anne's body suggests one very important thing about this case that you could use to throw it all out. Circumstances be damned. Anne's personality and behavior be damned. The testimony of her children. This ex-boyfriend from high school. John's testimony. Anything else that might be helpful, like receipts or the location of passports or all of her clothes being at home. And then it's this. If we don't have Anne's body, how can we be sure that Anne is dead? And if Anne is not dead, if we can't even say for beyond a shadow of a doubt that Anne is dead, how can we say that she's been murdered? It's entirely possible that Anne died, but not of murder. And so you're taking two big, huge leaps there based on circumstantial evidence. Not only is that she's been murdered, but that she's even dead when you don't have a body. And it takes a pretty damn convicted, no pun intended, prosecutor to even go for that.
Yeah, they were everybody. There's a book about this that I read some of for this case. And I want to make sure that I get this correct. It's called You'll Never Find My Body by Don Lassiter. And Don Lassiter sat in on the entire trial, took notes, and wrote this book based on the testimony that was provided. I believe he also talked to a couple of the investigators and things like that throughout the case. The trial and everything about their experience or after, whatever. Regardless, he does mention in the book that the prosecutors and the investigators were extremely, and the sheriff, were very, very confident and very fired up about it. And they did have a lot of conviction. Sheriff said, basically, we know he did it. We just don't have the body to prove it. But we know he did it, which is like a flashy, fun thing to say for the press, right? But typically, if prosecutors, we've said this before, if prosecutors don't believe they're going to win a case, they usually don't go for it. They'll plea out or drop it or whatever. But obviously, there's a lot of things that happened, probably that we don't know about, or evidence that came out that we don't really know about, right? Because not everything goes to trial, by the way. There's a lot of things that aren't allowed. And that was actually part of the appeal process, because he appealed multiple times. And one of the appeals was that they broke case law saying that the prosecution didn't provide all of the discovery to the defense, or they didn't do it properly, right? So there's a lot of things that you would be shocked to know that happen in a case that don't ever actually make it to trial, and they're not allowed to even talk about it. And some of those things would either bring a conviction or not. It's actually kind of scary. But the fact that they were so confident about it, given the fact that, like you said, there's literally no forensic evidence, there's no body. All we have is the weirdness surrounding it and everybody's testimony about the kind of person that Anne was or is. I think personally the time that she's been gone and no one has heard from her was actually on the prosecution's side to convince the jury that she is in fact dead. Like, because there's no way she would be gone this long and not a single person would have heard from her.
Or her children, especially.
Right, exactly. So obviously it was pretty solid. All of his appeals got denied. They buttoned it up very nicely. And it is a head scratcher, to be honest, because even though I'm glad that it turned out that way, I do kind of wonder. I wish I could have sat in on that myself, because I would like to know. And I'll read this book. Maybe we'll do an update and I'll give a little bit more insight. It's a 400-page book. I didn't have time to read it this week, but I got the important stuff out of it. What?
I said, you'll get your time. The other thing that's
I was too busy watching Ken Burns documentaries.
Trying to get caught up on the outcome of the Civil War. Yeah. One final thing I want to comment on this. Right now in this country, we have a weird, weird, weird idea about history and where this country is. We have this really strange idea being propagated by the media that this is a very racist and very backward country, and that we have come nowhere since the civil rights movement of the 1960s, that we're still a very backward country like we were in the 50s, the 40s, the 30s, whatever. As someone who's at least lived through enough of this or had enough interest in the human race as the time I've been alive, I'm going to tell you something. You know, we've never been a perfect country. We've never been a perfect people. But this is a case which took place in 1991. They did have a hard time adjudicating it because we didn't have all the evidence we needed. But we're talking about a law enforcement agency who doesn't have any of that thin blue line crap. They took a case that was cold and reopened it, knowing that they would be going after someone who's a former law enforcement officer. They knew that exposing this case to the public when they could have just let sleeping dogs lie would make them look bad in retrospect. Admittedly, you know, it was a different sheriff at the time, I'm sure, than it was in 1991, than when the conviction was made. But a police officer goes after justice, no matter who the suspect is. And a police officer goes after the party responsible ever so more ardently when a police officer may be the person who's involved. Nobody hates a bad police officer more than a police officer. And that needs to be said in the George Floyd era. And I want to say in 1991, we had police officers who probably believed that John was guilty of killing his wife and simply could not make the case stick. Could it have been because they were using psychics? Maybe. I don't know. You know, that's not the best investigative tool, in my opinion. Here's another part of it. This country right now, we're under this huge misappropriation of thought that if you're a person of a different race, that the police don't care about you. Anne's an Asian lady. This was in 1991, people. This was, you know, 35 years ago. This was a long time ago. And her case was treated with care and respect, and they attempted to solve it to the best of their ability, not having any physical evidence. And in fact, still not having any, they still decided that Anne was worth the investigation, that she was worth the expense of a trial, and that she was worth it to bring her husband to justice. And the modern media would tell you that prior to that conviction, that Anne was just another Asian woman in Southern California that the modern system just didn't care about. That is something you hear so often on podcasts and in media, that if the perpetrator's a cop and if the victim is the wrong color, that it's just never bound to be solved. This is two cases in a row. We handled Miles Bryant last week, and we're talking about this case this week. And this case was from the 90s. And I'm telling you now that this idea that we are a backwards country or a racist country, if we are that, we have only re-become that, I'm going to say, since 2008. And maybe that's all I'll say about that year, because certain people have definitely benefited from stoking the fires of enmity between races. Kendra, any final thoughts before we close it up?
No, I really appreciate you touching on that. And I think you said it eloquently. I agree with you 100%. And I have nothing really to add to that.
Thank you. I appreciate it when I can have a beautiful soliloquy and you're just like, ditto, boss.
Well, it was a gorgeous soliloquy with a nice period at the end of it. And I don't want to ruin it by saying anything else. So
thank you.
Well done. Folks, and I appreciate that a lot.
Thanks. If you want to send something to Kendra, you could send it to P.O. Box 1060, DeLand, Florida 32724. That's P.O. Box 1060, DeLand, Florida 32724. Kendra, you haven't gotten anything yet, have you?
No, I will admit that I haven't checked it.
Go check it.
I need to check. I've checked it a couple of times, but I haven't checked it recently. So I will go check it this week. And if there's something in it, I will open it live next week.
It's probably packed to the brim with thousands of angry spiders. Something that's very interesting. If you have a case that you would like us to cover here,
please don't send me angry insects. Okay. I will. That's one thing that I will be mad about. Don't do that.
She lives in Florida and she's mad that there's insects around her.
I have enough insects here and they're all pissed the fuck off.
This is did you know that this is a double brood year for cicadas? That we're going to have more cicadas hatching this year. So the last time we had this many hatching all at once was 1830, because one brood hatches like every 12 years and then one hatches every 17 years. And this year they overlap. It's going to be a double brood of cicadas.
We don't really get those a lot here, so I'm not too worried about it, but that's really gross.
We're fine. Cicadas are nasty. If you have a case, first of all, make sure it's a good case. Don't send us some lame ass case that's only interesting to you and no one else on earth and is really boring. And you think about it. Could John and Kendra talk about this for an hour, or will it be 5 minutes? And then I want you to take that case and then one source, whether it's a Wikipedia article or a newspaper thing or something that doesn't have a paywall on it. And I want you to email that to True Crime Drama. That's True Crime, JRAMA at gmail.com. That's Kendra's email that she checks 10,000 times per second. She will be looking for those for your cases so that she can bring them live to the air to give her expertise as a former sheriff's deputy and me as some guy who apparently went to college, I guess, to talk about these cases. And we will talk about them on the show and we will honor you, the Wolfpack. We appreciate you guys watching the show. We also want to remind you of the thing that Tansy has going on. You can become a sponsor of the We Defy Foundation. I know what you're thinking. What the hell is WeDefy? Well, WeDefy provides combat veterans from the United States only, coping with military-connected disabilities and long-term means to overcome their challenges through the physical combat of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Gives them something to focus their time, energy, both physical and mental on. Gives them something to pursue goals and challenges and overcome things and become badasses in the process. You could go to WeDefyFoundation.org, and if you don't want to do that, that's fine. You could also leave us a super chat. All super chats that have the remark in them, WeDefy or whatever, all that money will go over to the WeDefy Foundation. It's true, when you send us a super chat, YouTube takes a cut of that money. However, we will be covering YouTube's cut, so YouTube will be also be sort of by way of us donating to this as well. We appreciate you guys doing that. And then also just check out Gatekeeper Coffee. They're my buddy.
I'm going to get that Mexican chocolate coffee for real as soon as we are done here. That sounds so good.
Yeah, they literally, the beans are out there in Southern California where these two guys are. They go collect the beans from the field, they grind it up, and they'll send it to you immediately. Like today, I reached out to them about advertising, and I said, like, what are you guys about? And he goes, well, and then I got like four videos from them because the guy's like so excited to possibly be taking this to a broader audience, because it's literally two correctional officers who want to make coffee for the whole world. And like, you and I are small business people, obviously. And they just seem like cool guys. And he was telling me all about their business. And I'm just like, do you even listen to Hard Time, my corrections podcast? Because our missions are the same mission. He's like explaining to me what it's like to be a correctional officer. He's like, and you know, the cops, you know, they get firearms and we deal exclusively with criminals and we're locked in there all day. And he's like telling me like what sucks about being a correctional officer. And I'm just like, bro, I got you. I remember. I was there. Like every night I'm back in prison thanks to my nightmares. So, you know, you don't have to explain it all to me.
I got a podcast for you.
I sent him the podcast and I said, let's collaborate on there. You guys come on there, break down cases, talk about what you're passionate about, because why the hell not? Anyway, I appreciate those guys. Kendra, thanks for making time for me and fitting me into your busy life. I hope that you enjoy your vacation. Kendra going on a little vacation.
I am.
But we're not going to let True Crime lapse. We'll be back here next week in some form or another to bring you another scintillating and titillating and totally not cock tease true crime case.
Kendra, hate that.
Well, we'll discuss why after we're off the air. I'm going to go eat my eggs in the parking lot.
I'm going to go eat my old tomatoes in my bed.
Not a euphemism. All right. Guns up, giddy up. Good night, America.
Good night, America.
Goodbye, Will.
Bye.
Don't get yourself true crimed. That's what you're supposed to say.
Oh, yeah. Don't get yourself true crimed.